Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, open source Mantle super cheap SSDs. How many petabytes can you run through an SSD? Overclocking the Titan Z, home theater PC cases, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 272, recorded June 19th, 2014, SSDs and open source AMD. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the useful, most helpful, most informative, most delightful, most charming, and most exciting news, and occasionally some depressing and anger-raising news. Computer hardware, and yeah, we love mobile, we love tablets, we love cell phones. I have a new cell phone without a cracked screen, and it's Android, so, you know, hell is probably frozen over. I'm Patrick Norton, and the laugh you just heard was from Mr. Ryan Shrout, who, like myself, has recently been covered in automotive fluids. How's it going, man?
Yeah, it makes for interesting days. But hey, welcome to the world of Android. Is that your new primary phone, or is that something you're kind of playing around with testing right now?
It is my new primary phone. It's a Moto G, the new 4G LTE version of the Motorola G. What I really want is an iPhone 5S because I covet the camera on the iPhone 5S. Covet, because it's such a badass camera. And I use the camera on my phone constantly, or did with the iPhone 4S. But I wasn't going to buy, I wasn't going to spend like $600 on an iPhone 5S or tie myself into a 2-year contract mere days or months, couple, 3 months before what I presume will be the iPhone 6 or the iPhone 5X or the iPhone 5T or whatever the next version of the iPhone is going to be when it comes out in September. Excuse me, when it is announced in September. So it's too close to spend that kind of money.
Understood.
Although it's kind of funny. I can tell, great screen, really fast, nice processor. They save a little money on the camera on the 5G. Excuse me, on the Motorola G, on the Moto G. But that is neither here nor there, and the review of that's coming up after I get my 4G LTE experience with AT&T sorted out, because APN settings are fun, people, and if you haven't played around with your APN settings, you haven't lived as a geek. Dude, should we just start out with the open source GameWorks competitor, a.k.a. Mantle for Linux, a.k.a. AMD's latest bid for world domination on all platforms and all environments?
They're trying, aren't they?
They're trying. I admire their spirit.
On Tuesday, we actually hosted a live interview here at our office with AMD's Richard Huddy, who has the interesting title of gaming scientist. And as I had him explain it in the video, if you go watch the interview, the gaming scientist, as it's presented from AMD, is meant to facilitate discussions between the hardware engineers and the game developers, the software developers that utilize that hardware. So the idea is to make sure that the hardware vendor is the engineers are doing what the software vendors want them to do, and vice versa, and to kind of facilitate new cool tech being introduced into the ecosystem as often as possible. It's a pretty cool job. Richard has a long history in the industry. Started at 3D Labs. Was actually before that worked for the company whose name I am blanking on right now that Microsoft purchased in order to create the original DirectX. And then he worked at NVIDIA. He worked at ATI. He was part of the group when it was acquired by AMD. Worked for Intel. And then now is back at AMD at this particular role. We've had vendors out to our studio quite often to talk about products and to talk about new technologies. But they weren't actually talking about new products or new technologies. Rather, wanted to give kind of a state of the world, if you will, in 3D graphics as they saw it. And it's a really, really interesting interview. I'm not going to go over everything that was discussed. It's about 90 minutes long. But if you have any interest in gaming or graphics, it's definitely worth a watch. He's an engaging speaker, funny, and has a lot of interesting things to say. But what was cool was there are a handful of kind of news items that he discussed. It was the first time I'd heard of anything, and the first time I think anybody had heard of some of this stuff. Maybe the most interesting of which was that they are in the planning stages of something called OpenWorks. That's kind of a working title. They don't know what they're going to call it. But if you remember our discussions over the last several weeks about NVIDIA GameWorks and AMD's problems with it, and how it was not an API anymore, and how it had become a middleware, and how it could potentially damage the performance of AMD graphics cards going forward, or in AMD card users. And basically what AMD seems like they're planning to do, although I don't know exactly when they would implement it, is they want to create like an open source repository of code for these same types of visual effects. So like Tress effects would be one of the items in such a repository. There might be a lighting effects or engine effects or hair effects that would be included in this repository, but then it would be open source. So anybody from any other company or software developer or a hardware vendor could come in and modify the code, tweak it so that it runs a little bit better on their hardware than it did before. They could add new effects in so that the rest of the community would be able to utilize those effects and change them and integrate them in their engine as they would. Basically, an attempt to create an open source version of what NVIDIA GameWorks is today, or what NVIDIA wants it to become. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting idea. And it all comes down, it comes down to the debate of, are companies, how willing are companies to donate their time and resources and intellectual property into this kind of community-based thing that would, I believe it would actually improve the experience for pretty much anybody that takes advantage of it? Or are these companies going to be more interested in their self-preservation? You know, they don't want to share any of the new cool effects that they have. They don't want to allow their competing software vendors to, you know, have access to any of their IP, or their hardware vendors to have access to any of their special effects that they would create. And it really kind of comes down to the majority of the time, the fundamental difference between what AMD's goals are and what NVIDIA's goals are. I don't think NVIDIA has any negative intentions with what they do, but they seem very content to, you know, focus on their user base as opposed to, let's make sure everybody across all user bases is having a fair and equal treatment of things. Right. And I thought it was interesting. And it's, like I said, it's in the planning stages. It's a beginning thing that could happen. But its success depends not on AMD, you know, simply creating the repository. The success depends on other organizations and other companies using it, utilizing it, adding to it, mm-hmm. modifying it, and making it a useful resource as opposed to just a new name for what AMD has already been doing for years and years. That was probably the most, I would say, the most startlingly new thing that Richard Huddy mentioned in that. Hey, they also talked about the timeline for when so that would be by the end of 2014, mm-hmm. where Intel or NVIDIA would have access to the SDK to, if they wanted to, write a driver that could run Mantle games. Uh-huh. I don't think that will happen, but they would have the opportunity to. They talked about Mantle possibly coming to Linux, and that would be interesting because that would be the first kind of competitor to OpenGL in terms of APIs on SteamOS and Linux-based gaming systems. And they talked about the adaptive sync, FreeSync differences and availability of that and stuff. I mean, there were some interesting things in there. I don't know if any of those other topics really stood out to you individually or anything, but I wrote up a news post that kind of summarizes what I thought the interesting, unique things he mentioned were, that were new news as opposed to stuff that we had heard before. But the whole interview is actually really, really good, I think. And if you missed it live, you should have been there live, because we gave away $3,000 worth of graphics cards as well.
I'm pretty sure I'm exempt from those kind of contests.
You are not eligible. That's true.
I am not eligible. I was also pouring antifreeze into a car at that point. I mean, it's interesting to watch, like, kind of the motivations and the longer goals of both AMD and NVIDIA as they try to sort of, it still comes down to, like, can I manipulate the market? Can I control the market? Can I get the advantage? And man, I don't know. I think it's a wait and see situation.
It is. And AMD is not, AMD has always played the, we're the open source, we're the open company when it comes to these types of things. But that is, you know, in reality, NVIDIA is still the market share leader in discrete graphics, mm-hmm. like 65 to 35. Right. And when you're the 65% market share leader, you can take some of those other stances, right? When you are the low end of that market share, when you're the 35% guy, it's very hard to say, this is how we're going to do it and everybody has to follow our lead, because some developers may say, yeah, but they're the bigger audience, so we're just going to go there. So if you're AMD, you kind of have to take that open source approach. We want to work with everybody because you are trying to gain market share so that you can kind of become that dominant leader. And AMD is in that position on the processor side, on the APU side, on the desktop graphics side. So that's why as a company as a whole, they kind of maintain that same outlook for open versus closed source type stuff. So it would be interesting to see if in some future where AMD takes market share back from NVIDIA or from Intel or from, you know, in the tablet space, do they continue with the openness? Because it essentially leaves you less of an advantage over your competition. So it is where it is. I don't think we're going to see drastic changes in market share in the next, well, definitely not between now and the next episode of our podcast. So if anything changes, we'll be able to let them know.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we wait with bated breath. I was a little disappointed at Alan's conclusions with Seagate's desktop SSHD 4 terabyte review. Big hybrid, little cache. I think it comes down to it works well. It's a fast hard drive. It's a full-size hard drive. It's not a 2.5-inch hard drive. But that the new line of desktop SSHDs are only still only using like 8 gigabytes of cache, despite the fact that they've created much larger drives to access that cache, which I guess I'm kind of paying it backwards. Like with the 2.5-inch drives, it shows 8 gigabytes of cache, right? With a hybrid drive, essentially, mm-hmm. data is cached on this big chunk of cache on the drive to speed up access to that. So the operating system or the applications you use the most. And despite the fact that they made much, much larger drives, i.e. you can store a lot more data or a lot more applications or a lot more projects you're working on, they chose to stick with the 8 gigabyte cache on the new series of drives. Did Alan sort of add anything to that in the review last night? It seems like they work well.
yeah.
Nice.
I agree that it's a little odd because flash memory is so cheap now that you would think going from... We've been at 8 for a long time on these types of SSHDs. So going from 8 to 16 or 32, I would think would not, you know, a lot of the cost is the controller. And then adding extra flash should be, I think, relatively inexpensive. Maybe there's some complication that I don't know of that would cause it otherwise. But it was interesting, right? Because Alan did his normal benchmarking and testing on it, and we were kind of talking about the results. And, you know, this is kind of what you expect as soon as you extend past, because most benchmarks are doing more than 8 gigs of data worth of testing. So as soon as you cross out of that 8 gigs of cache, performance drops down to a standard hard drive, and now you're performing on a standard hard drive. Very kind of obvious and uninteresting data. So what we did do was, I suggested that we do this kind of, let's get out the old stopwatch and go mm-hmm. for user experience type stuff. And if you look at the last, I think it was the second to last page of the review, and on the page that looks at cache roll-off is where we test things like rebooting machine several times in a row, starting up Battlefield 4 several times in a row, and then like intermixing those things. And what changes mm-hmm. does it occur? Like, for example, if you look at the left-hand side towards the bottom, Burke, you'll see that like the first boot time is 26 seconds, but after that, it got down to as low as 9.4 seconds, right? And that is, we rebooted, we got it to idle, we rebooted, got it to idle, rebooted, got it to idle. So the Windows was cached and it booted correctly. And then the green lines are the starts of Battlefield 4. And you can see the first time we started, it took 52 seconds, second time, 37 seconds. That's a big drop, right? That's a huge improvement. But we rebooted one time. After that, you reboot and we're back to a 24-second reboot time, very close to the original 26-second time. And then when you go back into Windows and restart Battlefield, you're adding some time onto that as well. So you can kind of see that 8 gigs of cache is really not a lot. You know, several reboots of an operating system is going to clear that out. Several, you know, all we did with Battlefield 4 was start up the game and load up one specific map. We didn't even like play it for an extended period of time. All that was loading all the cache and texture data that it needs to load up through the system and out into the graphics card. So caching on hard drives still has some advantages, but from what Alan told us last night, it's like 8 gigs is not the right size for this anymore. It may have been several years ago, and it might have been the only cost-effective way to do it, because when you're talking about hard drives, people have certain expectations on price per gigabyte. 30 gigs, 40 gigs, 60 gigs, that is kind of the level where caching makes sense. Mm-hmm. And you can probably get 64 gig SSDs for $50 now. Right. I haven't looked in a while, but 40 or 50 bucks would be my guess. And those make more sense. And you combine it with your traditional hard drive and you use the Intel RST technology and you're getting the exact same effect, but you're getting more benefit, right? You could have the entirety of Battlefield 4 kind of stored in that SSD cache, and you wouldn't have any of these kind of roll-off issues. I think these hyperdrives make more sense in that 2.5-inch form factor in notebooks where you don't have the option to have two drives.
Sure.
Where you can't do a hard drive plus an SSD cache or a big SSD and a big storage drive. It makes more sense to have them there. But in a desktop format like this, it just doesn't seem that the value is really there.
Unless you get into something like Western Digital's Black 2, where they have essentially a full, 128 gigabyte SSD and a 1 terabyte drive in there. 120 gigabyte SSD. Yeah, you know what I mean? But it's a shame that Seagate didn't take this opportunity to build a massive amount of cash on this.
Yeah, I agree.
How'd things go with overclocking the Titan Z?
Very interestingly, actually. When we talked about it before, the Titan Z's advantage over the 295X2 really comes down to the fact that it has 125-watt lower TDP than the AMD card. Mm-hmm. So it has lower performance, but it's a little bit quieter. The fact that they remained within PCI Express specifications while AMD chose to not, whether or not you really care about that kind of stuff. When we overclocked, it was interesting. Even if you didn't overclock it, it depends on what your definition of overclocking is at this point. With the NVIDIA cards, you can just increase the power target, which is you're basically telling the GPU or the graphics card, hey, instead of running at 375 watts, I'll let you run at 112% of that or 120% of that. That's your new limit, right? And just increasing that to 112% took our average clock speed from 894 megahertz at stock mm-hmm. to 993 megahertz. At 112%. So you got 100 megahertz average frequency increase just by increasing that power target. Now, when you increase that power target, your power draw goes up, your noise goes up because the GPUs are getting hotter, the fan has to spin faster to make up for that because it wants to keep the GPUs at the same temperature. Mm-hmm. And when we took that up to 120%, we went from like 994 to 1018, so a little bit more performance out of it. And then at maximum power, the kind of default power setting of 120% that we could boost up to, plus adding, I think the most we could get stable was 75 additional megahertz. We got all the way up to over like 1,075 megahertz is kind of the average clock. And when you do that, you're going from 894 to 1,074, 180 megahertz frequency increase. That's a dramatic mm-hmm. performance difference. And it kind of closes the gap between the Titan Z and the 295X2 in terms of performance. But it does so at the cost of now you're making the Titan Z draw as much power as the 295X2. And it's actually louder than the 295X2 because this Titan Z only has one single center-mounted fan on it. And it has to cool the entirety of two GK110 GPUs. So it's spinning, I think it was at stock settings, 2,000 RPM. Overclock settings, 2,700 RPM. That's a mm-hmm. that's a big jump percentage-wise, and the fan got quite loud. The 295X2, on the other hand, has a center-mounted fan to cool the heat sinks as well as two water blocks on there and an external 120-millimeter radiator. So even though they're totally different cooling solutions, at the same kind of power levels, the 295X2 has a better cooling option in terms of noise, and it takes up more space because you've got this radiator to deal with, but I think it's the better option of the two. But it was interesting to look at what could you push the Titan Z up to? What could NVIDIA have pushed the Titan Z up to had they been willing to, you know, sacrifice their advantage in power consumption, sacrifice their advantage in noise levels? And they just chose not to go that route. And, you know, even if you match performance and you're, even if you match performance and you match sound and you match power, if you're still $1,500 more expensive, you're probably still going to lose that battle. So at that point, is it even really worth trying? Leave it down at the settings where you said it was going to be originally, sell to who you can sell to, and kind of move on to the next generation.
I think that makes sense. I don't know, that whole corner of the market is so beyond the average consumer or even the extraordinary consumer at this point. And they're going for such an unusual customer profile. TechPort's SSD Endurance, the Petabyte Club. So we've been following this. TechReport grabbed a fistful, I guess, five SSDs and basically decided to just run them to failure. And three SSDs are soldiering forward. Scott kind of summarized this TechReport article. We've reached the 1,000 terabyte mark, which is at least five times more than any of the survivors are rated for. So they literally have just been abusing these drives. The Corsair Neutron GTX, the Samsung 840 Pro, and the Kingston HyperX 3K. Technically, the HyperX was able to reach 1 petabyte of written data with performing only 716 terabytes of actual writes due to compression, which is kind of interesting. And of course, each of the drives are less than pristine, Scott writes. The Corsair Neutron GTX 240 gigabyte was slowly decreasing its life attributes since the beginning, claiming to be somewhere between 75 and 80% with a fairly linear decline. If this trend continues, the drive will reach zero at around 4 to 5 petabytes of writes. And its read speed apparently has substantially dropped from the time between 900 terabytes and 1,000 terabytes of total writes, from 500 megabytes per second to just under 400 megabytes per second. So it's interesting, basically, as it reallocates sectors, as it compensates for failing memory on the drive. But the other two drives, Scott summarizes, are a remarkable success story. You know, the Kingston HyperX drive is reporting itself to be substantially worse off within the last 10% of its life. That said, even though it claims to be pining for the Fjords, it is still working and has only reported a couple of reallocated sectors, those occurring in the last 100 terabytes of writes. So to put it into context, right, if they've written a petabyte, and a petabyte is five times the number of actual writes they're supposed to be go through, you know what I mean? It's reporting itself at 10% it's got like minimal sectors failures. It's claiming it's within 10% of its end of life. And it's been writing for five times, its rated number of writes. And the Samsung 840 Pro, apparently had a couple of reallocated sectors. Each 100 terabytes yields about 500 reallocations, but apparently it is still going strong at the same performance. It's a really good article. If you've never been, if you haven't been following the series, go to the Tech Report to take a look at that. It is a pretty awesome test. I also laughed really hard because I had forwarded this article out, I tweeted this article out, and the immediate response, like the first tweet back was, well, it's only a single sample. They should have had multiple samples of each. And I'm like, you know, I bet if you buy them five each of these drives, they'll be happy to recreate this at your out-of-pocket expense. And I did not get any tweets back. So I was a little disappointed about that. But it's a really cool, it's, you know, given the kind of foo-rah we've had over the years as SSDs have kind of gone from these you know, unicorns, these rarities, to something that's almost a standard on laptops and becoming a standard on desktops, you know, and we're looking at new 500 gigabyte drives showing up for unbelievably low, like, you know, 38 cents a gigabyte. It's interesting to see that the reliability on these may be considerably better than anecdotal evidence would indicate. Because at one point I ran into somebody who had four drives fail in the space of 6 months. You know, and that was not the most unusual experience. Did Alan talk up what's going on with SanDisk buying Fusion.io? Because I laughed because I was like, wait a minute, isn't that the weather app company?
Which one, SanDisk or Fusion.io?
Fusion.io.
So Fusion.io, it was kind of the first big player to try to get into enterprise flash. They put on the map more or less when Steve Wozniak kind of became their lead scientist or something like that, mm-hmm. after the company had already been formed and had been producing products. But they were making stuff really, really targeted at enterprise, anywhere from $8,000 to $50,000 SSD combinations, right? And these were all PCI Express based. These were the first to get into the multi-terabyte SSDs, and they had really, really impressive performance specifications. They had some limitations. There was actually a very minimal controller on the Fusion I/O cards. Instead, right. the driver itself in the operating system was more responsible mm-hmm. for doing wear leveling and checking on the status of the cards and the performance of the cards that way.
Right.
And it was innovative at first, and it really did interesting things. And I think that graph that we're showing right now actually shows you when we first did a review of an I/O drive, the 160, that green line, it showed you kind of how it outperformed everything right. else in the mix, right? Even the Revo drive, which was another PCI Express based option at the time. But if you scroll down and look at the next graph that shows you the same benchmark statistic, but a couple of years later, a couple, 3 years later, you'll see that in this case, it's the purple line that is referencing that same I/O drive 160. And above that, you have quite a few other SSDs that are matching it or beating in performance. Revo Drive 3, the OCZ Z Drive R4, and of course, the right. recently released the Intel SSD DCP3700. So those are significantly faster and significantly cheaper than what Fusion I/O has done. So Fusion I/O was, I think they were, I don't want to say they were in need of being purchased, mm-hmm. but it kind of made sense that they were maybe on the lookout for somebody. And you look at Toshiba bought OCZ and Western Digital bought a different enterprise solid state company. SanDisk, I think most people that listen to the show or watch it are probably would be surprised to learn how big of a company SanDisk is.
They're huge.
You think they only make SD cards or compact right. flash or something, but they're an enormous provider of memory in all sorts of forms. So spending $1.1 billion for Fusion I/O isn't a huge chunk of money to them, and it gets them an automatic play into the enterprise market. And I hope what it will do is maybe give Fusion I/O a little bit more flexibility to expand on its portfolio and maybe move into the idea of creating the controller that can be on the board, offload some of that compute horsepower from the mm-hmm. primary system processor onto the device itself, and then improving in those areas where its specifications fall behind things like the Intel P3700. Right. That like their devices are running at PCI 2.0 instead of PCI 3.0. There are areas that they could improve on. 4K random read IOPS, for example, they fall pretty far behind on Intel, but they're winning on the right IOPS, but it's cached and it's a little bit different. They cannot sustain those speeds. So that Alan made that table there with the kind of show you the comparisons and differences, with the advantages being they're emboldened. So also pricing would have to change as well. Enterprise markets are obviously more flexible when it comes to pricing, but anybody would love to save a little bit of money. So I'm curious to see what happens with Fusion I/O going forward. How do they, how do they really change mm-hmm. in the next 12 to 24 months? Does their product line change? And I'm pretty sure it will. I don't think if you kind of watch what the stock had done with Fusion I/O, it had kind of been in a similar decline to OCZ's, not quite that right. low, but it had been on the same pathway for quite some time. And they were just able to find a buyer before they had to find a buyer. And I think their technology, they have a lot more in-house technology than what OCZ does, but it's still in need of some refreshing, I think. And I think SanDisk gives them the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, SanDisk has really deep pockets. Fusion I/O actually apparently has a really interesting market portfolio. And it's kind of funny because at the enterprise level, I clicked on something and it's like Seagate had purchased last year Avago's flash business. Western Digital's bought companies. It's one of those thick situations where we're watching a market consolidate. And because people see a lot of opportunities, I think all of these major manufacturers are looking at, you know, Google and Amazon and everybody on the planet scaling up these insane blade server environments. And it's like, okay, the next thing to go is we're going to go from rotating hard drives to flash drives and trying to position themselves to be the right player at the right time. I don't know how much it's going to impact consumers, except maybe in making the interwebs faster and more awesome and consuming less power in the process. It's curious. It's also amazing. Like, I think Alan says it was $40 a gigabyte when the Fusion IO drives first came out. You know, which is...
Takes you back, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Because it was... I remember somebody saying, like... I'm sorry. I was just like letting somebody know to not lock me in. The it was one of those things. Like a friend of mine said, he's like, yeah, we're spending, you know, this gigantic amount of money was on a fiber optic network system for this Wall Street firm. He's like, but you know, if we gain a half second here and 0.3 seconds there, and you know, it turns into several more $1 billion a year in earnings. Mm-hmm. So wow, it's kind of funny, you know. Your perspective on something changes radically based on the amount of money those hardware improvements might yield for you over the long run. Anyhow, good luck to Fusion IO and to SanDisk. Watch Dogs, this has been interesting to watch. Like, I think somebody said 1,000 YouTube videos have been created in the last couple of days as these mods come out. And the general consensus is that Watch Dogs looked really good when it was debuted at E3. And people are like, oh, the PC version has been crippled because the console versions look so bad. And it's the worst mod for Watch Dogs. Restore the bloom effects from the game's E3 2012 trailers. Basically, these mods from the worst are apparently reducing stuttering and improving other effects, such as, quote, adding bokeh DOF blurring, Scott notices in his write-up. What do you think? You know, Guru3D has a pretty good thread on this. There's a ton of videos on the internet. Does it look that much better? Are you thrilled and excited? Are you frustrated with the publisher for seemingly stripping out a bunch of the cool stuff? Or do you think this is a classic game that shipped feature incomplete?
It's probably a little bit of everything. I'd say I'm more excited than anything, right? A lot of games will have, what was the most famous one recently? It was like, there was an Aliens game, Aliens Resurrection, I think, that got in trouble, you know, in the media and in the public for, you know, having a demo and having trailers and having screenshots that just looked nothing like what happened in the game. And with Watch Dogs, you know, I remember seeing a demo of it in person when it looked like this and thinking, wow, this is really impressive. And then last November, I actually went to the Ubisoft offices up in Montreal, and we weren't really there specifically to see Watch Dogs, but we got to see some of it in passing, even while people were working on it. And I remember thinking, I don't remember it looking like this. I thought it looked much better. Everything looked flat. Everything looked kind of washed out. It didn't have the jump that things did before. And I do find it very surprising that, I guess I find it surprising that companies don't think that this stuff will be found, right? So if these shaders, if there was some reason, if there's some bug that causes horrible erase your SSD data loss or something like that when it gets run, or for some legitimate reason, if you didn't want people to find this, you would take that out. It can't be much more difficult than find replace or something like that if it's a totally different shader. And so the modders being able to find this and turn it on, you know, we kind of wonder, did somebody in the company maybe whisper out to others and say, hey, if you look here and here, maybe you'll find something interesting? And you find a shader with the name E3 2012, and you go, oh, let's turn this on, see what it does. And I haven't actually booted it up and installed it and kind of changed it on my side, but I definitely want to, because a lot of the reports are saying that there's not a significant performance hit either. Which wouldn't make much sense then why they would choose to kind of downgrade the visual quality. Now, maybe that's only on a couple of specific hardware instances. Maybe for many other hardware combinations, maybe specifically consoles, that there is some very significant performance deficit. But we don't really know that yet. And I don't think, you know, some people were asking me, is this worth going in and like doing a whole benchmarking session on with a bunch of cards and seeing how it looks. And it's kind of a hassle to enable this. It's not something that's ever going to show up in the options menu. So maybe a couple of them would be interesting, but not spending a whole bunch of time. And I think the majority of people that play this are probably, they're definitely not going to hack through their game to install mods for this. But the fact that it was just left in seems very odd to me. You know, conspiracy theories will abound for sure about NVIDIA paying off somebody or, you know, the developer running out of time or an AMD graphics driver being right. totally broken. So they had to revert it for PCs and consoles or something like that. But it just, people are going to find this stuff and I'm glad they do. Right. Like this,
right.
this is the fact that this exists out of the box, as opposed to what people had to do with Skyrim, where they heavily modified things to make it look mm-hmm. better, but they did that over time. This is, yeah. this is kind of a totally different thing.
You also wonder, it's like, it's funny. It's, The Trenches is a comics by that's kind of published by the Penny Arcade people. And it's interesting because not so much the comic's nice, but below the comic are sort of these anonymous recountings of people that worked at game developers. And the stories that come out, some of them are positive, but especially the ones that come out of Q&A tend to be really depressing because it gives you an idea of the kind of, you know, deadline and release pressures and testing pressures that and the sort of decisions that are made. And if you've ever, you know, bought a $50 or $60 game, and it almost feels like this happened more when stuff was shipped in a box and they had to physically burn a CD and then a DVD and ship that to you, and then you would get it. And I can remember one game that wouldn't actually, the version out of the box wouldn't actually play because there'd be this, like, you know, you it wouldn't launch, and then you searched online, you'd have found the patch, and I think it was a 3-hour download for the patch because the internet was delivered by angry snails at that point. And you know, with you know, Steam and online games, it's a little less vicious, right? Because you're not physically creating a product in a box to ship to somebody most of the time. And then I think to myself about Xbox 360 releases, but it's funny what shows up, and it's peculiar that some of the decisions that are made, and you don't know why they were made. Or, you know, did they think, you know, where they were going to, like, okay, we're going to make these grand patches and we're, you know, maybe they're going to release additional texture maps or something. But you look at the list on the Guru 3D forums, and it's like, it's kind of a crazy list at this point on the mod, right? Changes to the fog values, enabled bokeh for the main cameras, stuttering improvements, the E3 bloom effects, performance improvements, headlight shadows, LOD changes, reflections changes, 3 new cameras to the game, closer normal further, high quality raindrops, properly reacting to light. Basically, then I found a whole bunch of settings for the rains, lens flares, lighting changes, civilians density changes. I have no idea what that one means. You know, but it's kind of crazy when you think about all of this being buried and not released in a game. And then, of course, the internet starts coming up with their theories as to why these things weren't released.
Yeah. There was a statement put out by Ubisoft that somebody linked in the chat room that we saw on PC Gamer. And mm-hmm. they basically commented on it. They were deactivated for a variety of reasons, including possible impacts on visual fidelity, stability, performance, and overall gameplay quality. Yeah, difficulty in reading the environment in order to appreciate the gameplay to potentially making the game less enjoyable or even unstable. That was kind of the official Ubisoft comment on it. So pretty, you know, kind of what you would expect to hear from them, regardless of what is actually the case. So
we did it to protect your own risk. The children. Oh, my goodness. I don't believe I said that. Now on Amazon, 1 terabyte Samsung A40 Evo SSD 4. Ladies and gentlemen, brace yourselves. $399. And the Asus PB287Q, that's their 4K flat panel, for $649. Have you bought both of these devices, or are you merely considering purchasing all these devices?
Well, Asus is still trying to get that 4K monitor back from me. So as long as it sits here, then I don't have to purchase one. So that's good for me. But somebody linked me to this Samsung SSD selling today for $399, a 1 terabyte SSD for $399, and a good 1 terabyte SSD
yeah.
for $399. Brings it to, if my math checks out, $0.39 per gigabyte. And that actually is beating the current pricing of the Crucial MX100, which was our, I think 3 weeks ago or so, our favorite SSD for cost. So this competition is working, everybody. It's working to everybody's advantage. I think the cheapest I had seen this drive before this was like $435 or $440 or so. Right. So they dropped the price some more, and you're getting under 40 cents per gigabyte for this drive. And I happened to look under Amazon, you know, they list all of their popular items by by category. If you look at the best-selling ranks of the internal solid-state drives, the Evo 250 gig model is number one. Mm-hmm. The 1 terabyte model is number two. The 500 gig model is number three, and the 120 gig model is number four. So they have a clean sweep of one through four on that, which is pretty impressive to see, actually.
I don't think it's probably happened a lot in the last few years. We should also point out that Crucial MX100, the largest size on that is 512 gigabytes, and it is still selling for a whopping $219. So if you're looking for – that is $30 less than the 840 in 500 gigabytes. Should you be looking to save another – should you be looking to save $30 on your next 500 gigabyte SSD purchase? Yeah. I'm still not entirely sure I want a 4K 28-inch monitor, but a 4K 32-inch monitor is pretty badass. Just because I love stoking the rumor mill, one last article I tacked on there that blew up on TechMeme today. Taiwan's Quanta to start mass production of Apple's smartwatch in July. Michael Gold wrote that up for Reuters. And the rumors... a source familiar with the matter, which is just such an, a source familiar with the matter, basically says that Apple is going to start, Apple has a contract with Quanta to start producing Apple's first smartwatch in July. Then, of course, goes on to mention the bitter rival, Samsung Electronics. Can Apple innovate against Samsung Electronics? The watch, which remains unnamed, but which will company followers have dubbed the iWatch, will be Apple's first foray into a niche product category that many remain skeptical about, especially as to whether it can drive profits amid cooling growth in tech gadgets, which is a polite way of saying, who's buying these? Is there any money here? And what are they going to be used for? Which, despite the fact that I have several friends that have smartwatches, they do kind of look at them and go, oh, I got a text message. And I'm not entirely sure there's a $250 market for that in the world.
Agreed.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. And of course, this being a rumor-filled report, apparently it will measure 2.5 inches diagonally and is, quote, slightly rectangular, according to one of the sources. It will have an arch shape protruding slightly from the band and will feature a touch interface and wireless charging capabilities. So, who knows? Maybe the iPhone 6 will be wireless charging. Maybe it will have a larger screen so it does not look so tiny compared to everything else in the phone store. But the best part is that Apple expects to ship 50 million units within the first year of the product's release, which, given the number of iPads they've sold, might not be unreasonable. I don't know. Once in a while, I like to take a rumor, partially because I want to ask everybody out there in the audience, in the chat room, if the idea of a smartwatch even remotely appeals to you, or if you would rather save that money to buy a faster GPU or a better monitor. So it's kind of curious. It's always funny watching product categories try to emerge. I mentioned this also because I've just been so enjoying the death of 3D as a major topic for HDTVs and projectors. Although they all still support 3D, what's the last time you heard anybody kind of get excited about 3D content or a 3D title launch? So, I don't know. It's kind of curious. I want to see new and exciting stuff. I'm also kind of curious about the next version of the Oculus Rift and whether or not that's going to make half the people I know who test it immediately run for the nearest garbage can. And I'm hoping not, because it would be nice. It would be nice to just finally see immersive gaming succeed. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address if you want to send us a question. I thought we actually had a sponsor in this episode.
Nope, not this week.
I'm so sorry. Must have been looking at last week's. So let's just fire up some questions. We got an email from Sean about lay flat ATX cases. He says, "Hey, Twitch crew, I recently built a gaming PC that I love, but I hate the case I put it into. That's the worst feeling. What I'm looking for is a home theater PC style horizontal laying case that has great cooling. My current build is an ATX motherboard with a Master Hyper Evo 212 heatsink. The GPU is a PMY GeForce GTX 760. I have an SSD and a hard drive. Do Twitch viewers have any ideas for this? I was looking at the Fractal Node 605, but a little worried about the price and the cooling, or the Silverstone Tech GD05B USB 3.0, a name that just continues to roll off my tongue and just promote searchability on Google or any buying catalog. First thing I want to say, it's not as big an issue as it used to be in the past. But the one thing I want to say is if you see any kind of sort of fluorescent or LCD flat panel, LED flat panel on the front of a home theater PC case, do not buy it if you're going to put it anywhere near the screen in your home theater room unless you have the ability to remotely turn it off. Because invariably, no matter how far you turn it down, it was the biggest issue with the VFD displays they were putting in them for a while. But a lot of times, it is incredibly distracting to the home theater experience to have a bright display position directly below your HD screen. And I don't find it any less irritating if you're using it in a desktop environment. I would also like to take a moment to remind everyone that a home theater, a traditional ATX case, will operate perfectly fine if you lay it on its side. That may put your monitor up too high to use, but I just want to point that out. And I would also tend to agree that home theater PC cases tend to be incredibly expensive compared to a lot of their, you know, mid-tower, full-tower brethren, because they're produced in much, much smaller volumes. So what did you think of the Fractal design case?
I had actually never seen these cases before. And when I read the question, I was trying to, I could not think of one ATX case that was meant to be laid down. So he suggested a couple in the email that I went ahead and started looking up. But the first thought I had really was, well, you can really lay any ATX case down on its side.
They just exactly
don't look like they're meant to be laid down on their side. I mean, I remember taking full-size ATX cases that were rack mountable if you turned them on their side. Right. So crazy things have happened. The Node 605 looks pretty good. It has all the features that he's looking for, but he talks about price potentially being a problem. And this, I think these cases are smaller run cases, so they probably are going to be a little bit more expensive. But I mean, if you're trying to get a whole bunch of components into a form factor like that, that also looks good on the front and looks like it was designed for it, I think the 605 looks really, 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 really nice. The Silverstone has more of, it looks like an older case. It looks like something that was made in the, mid 2000s, I guess. But it still has all the same functionality. It does have USB 3 on the front and everything. But it doesn't have the card reader configuration that the 605 has. So,
I would like to point out, if you look at the dimensions on both these cases, the Silverstone's 6 inches wide. The Fractal is 6.5 inches wide because of the feet. These are literally ATX cases that have been tipped on their sides, and the power button has been repositioned, and
the drive has been repositioned.
Your 5 1/4 inch drive will work positioned, in portrait mode rather than landscape mode. They have little nubs on the side of the cases for that. And part of the reason for this is because nobody wants to pay the expense for a 90-degree, PCI Express, card direction changer or riser device. A lot of them don't work very well. You can easily spend $50 to $150 on one that actually does work, which is more than the cost of the case. But that's part of the issue. If you want sort of a low form factor home theater case, you either need to not have a discrete GPU or you need to pay the money for something that's going to turn that GPU sideways off the motherboard and then almost invariably block all the other PCI Express slots on the motherboard. It's a little frustrating. I'm a big fan of just turning my PC case on its side.
As long as you don't have any fan vents or anything on the side that goes down, you can, even if you get one with a window, now you can look inside of it. Maybe you put some lights in it and stuff, right? And you actually have I think, a better use case for a case with the window than somebody who has it underneath their desk. So
true that.
If any readers or viewers rather have suggestions, something that they've tried and really like, send us an email, let me know, and we'll talk about them next week.
My goodness. I'd like to also apologize for hacking during this podcast. I have this monster summer cold right now that I'm trying to beat to death, and I'm failing miserably. yeah, it's also funny that cooling on those cases could be a little peculiar, because in a lot of cases they pull, because we've gotten so used to sort of segmented cooling designs where there's something that isolates the airflow on the power supply from the area with the graphics cards. And most of these cases just have sort of blunt force holes in the case you can stuff fans into. You might want to experiment with your fan settings, because the other thing is, if you put one of these on your desk, maybe underneath your monitor, you will notice the 32 fans inside of it a lot more than you would if it was underneath your desk. Ask me how I know. Roberto is looking for a four-way CF motherboard. He says, hello, guys. Love the show. I've been listening to your show for about 3 years now. Thanks, Roberto. Thank you for making it easy to be in the know of the latest tech without spending hours browsing the net. He says, I did a little bit of Litecoin mining at the beginning of the year, but I'm done with that now. However, I have some great hardware left that I want to use to build a killer 4K gaming PC. I would like for you guys to guide me to a good, cheap motherboard with 4 or 5. I don't know if they make them ports for graphics cards. Also, I have 2 power supplies. One is 850 watts. The other is 1,000 watt. I don't know if you recommend to get a new one with about 1600 to 1800 watts or to use something like an add-to PSU to run stable for a long time. I'd appreciate it so much if you could help me out. Ryan, I like this board. And he has a link to a Geekbyte Z97X Gaming G1 Wi-Fi BK Black Edition motherboard. It's kind of funny because, you know, the 99 boards are all sort of lurking at the corner of the testing bench. Would you recommend, you know, getting one of the newest generation motherboards, getting one of the older proven generation motherboards? Is there even
this board here that I put in is a Z97. So it's a Haswell ready platform that has support for 4-way crossfire in it. And
I just realized that I read your note being from Roberto's. Ryan's pick is the Z97X, which would sort of make my question about the Z99 motherboards redundant. So,
well, you know, actually, you have a good point, right? Because the alternative is to wait for the X99 motherboards the potential of Haswell E, but that's not going to be until late in 2014, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe Computex timeframe, they'll announce it IDF timeframe, they'll announce it, and then maybe it'll come out after that. Those would have enough native PCI Express lanes, I think. 8888, yeah. To support 4-way crossfire and SLI. Whereas motherboards that support it on like the Z97 have to use a PCI bridge controller to branch the single by 16 into 4x8 connections. But this motherboard does do that. And it will work for 4-way crossfire. It doesn't work for 4-way SLI, but it does work for 4-way crossfire, I think. So, you know, something to consider if you're doing 4-way graphics cards is that you are going to be more apt to be CPU bottlenecked. So if you are concerned about that, maybe the Haswell E processors with 8 cores, 16 threads will appeal to you more, but you're going to pay, you know, $500 or $600 for the processor, and you're going to pay, you know, probably $250 to $300 for that motherboard. Whereas here, I think this motherboard's maybe $220 or $200, I think. And you can pick up, you know, a Haswell 4770K or go to the 4790K, you know, the Devil's Canyon for $339. So, and also those are available pretty much immediately, while X99 is a future-looking product. So
How many motherboards are out there that can support 4 GPUs simultaneously at this point? It would seem that would be a very small subset of the motherboard market.
Yeah, it really is. And it's actually anything over 2 is a very small subset. You'll see some motherboards that will support 3-way crossfire, but 2-way SLI. And those boards are actually, they're using the primary 2 PCI Express slots via the PCI Express channels from the processor, and then they're probably using PCI Express from the chipset for that third graphics card slot. That introduces latency into the interface some, and it's obviously, it's also a by four connection, I think, instead of a by eight. So it's not ideal for that. And I probably wouldn't recommend going over two GPUs and motherboards like that. But this, there are a couple of boards in the Z87 lineup, right, and there's at least a couple of boards in the Z97 lineup. And I think Asus has one. It's their workstation board. It has all the standard features you would expect, but it's just a workstation labeled. It's the Z97WS, go figure, that supports that. And it has a PCI Express 3.0 bridge controller in it to support four GPUs, whereas this one does as well. So if you're reusing these GPUs for gaming now instead of mining, you know, you've already got the hardware, might as well use it. So if you can get a motherboard that supports it for not much more, then you can go that route. That's kind of where, if it were me, I'd probably go Z97X, that gigabyte board for right now.
It's funny when you mentioned, when he mentioned mining and you just mentioned it again, it made me realize, if you have a Synology, a DSM powered Synology NAS box, it is time to upgrade it. If you have to been upgrading it, because someone had taken advantage. There was a big news story that evolved the last couple of days, was how somebody had taken advantage of an exploit in the DSM operating system to mine something like 500,000 coins, which particular flavor of coins doesn't really matter, but it ends up being about 620,000 in current exchange rates, basically by maxing out the CPU on an unknown number, but let's call it a lot of DSM NAS boxes. And what's interesting about this is Synology actually patched this. They heard about this whole, because I was talking, we had one of the Synology boxes in for testing, and they had we got an email from the PR manager over there, and it was funny because they were notified of the flaw in September last year. They patched it by, like, you know, I think September 13th or 23rd. But people did not patch the holes, and then they released the beta of 5 on the last week of, you know, I would say January 20th, 25th, somewhere around there, and had patched the flaw in that 2 weeks later. And as a result of this story going out, they've defaulted the behavior on all operating system installs, DSM operating system installs, to have auto updates on, because as a result of them kind of, there's this like three-stage thing, is they posted the patch to the 5.0 beta and did a press release around it in February, at which point a bunch of people realized that their older DSM boxes were not patched, and then a flood of tech support inquiries, and then a company doing analysis for Dell was like, that's where all this activity is coming from. But it's kind of this larger story of the Internet of Things, right? Make sure your things are patched, and be really, you might want to pay attention to what's going on with your router box, your home router, and if it hasn't been patched in a long time, or the company that built it maybe even never did more than one or two updates for it, and it's a couple of years old, might want to start running OpenWRT or one of the other open source operating system options, because I think the Internet of Things is going to get really, really ugly, because the traditional pattern is that, you know, a chip is taped out, some software is assembled for that. You know, in many cases, a super simple interface is dropped on that sort of super beat up software that comes with the chip, and then the product is shipped to market. And the level of support may not get much better than that, which doesn't sound bad until you realize that maybe it's working on a 2 or 3 year old open, you know, relatively open kernel that's been heavily exploited. And if your device has never been patched, you run into the awesome opportunity that some appliance in your house, your internet connected toaster, might serve as a gateway for somebody to abuse the rest of your network, which sounds really simple or silly, or will sound really silly until somebody does it, right? You know, you may not care that somebody has access to your Nest until they turn your heat up to 120 degrees while you're on vacation and you come back to a $4,000 gas bill. It's
just like the credit card companies, right? I'm not responsible.
Yeah, the nice thing about the Nest is it patches itself automatically, and I think we're going to see that as the default behavior on a lot more stuff moving forward. It's an interesting concept, and I just wanted to let that loose. Just, you know, antivirus is no good if you don't update it, you know, just update it. patch your operating system, patch all your operating systems, patch all of your devices. Although Shannon and I, my co-host on TechZilla, Shannon Snubs, we had an argument over firmware upgrades for motherboards. And I come from the upgrade the firmware on your motherboard camp. And she comes from the don't upgrade the firmware on your motherboard camp until you know it's supposed to actually fix something that's wrong with your motherboard, which led to
I can subscribe to both of those. depending on my mood and day.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. But at some point, I just went into the, screw it. I'm going to upgrade the firmware. Certainly, it'll make something better somewhere, which I just absolutely horrified Snubs. It was a fun argument. One last one before we go. We got an email from Jay about those external GPU adapters we discussed last week. He says, you talked briefly about a desktop video card adapter for laptops. I've used a couple of these before. While these technically do work for gaming, albeit not that great, they are designed to be used for mobile professionals and especially in education for those working with research taking advantage of the compute extension to the GPU. Commonly, the researchers and people using these things are quite mobile, so taking a laptop is practical for them to hit a few campuses and research labs around the world. The places they would attend would typically have one of these units available. Just moving the project onto someone else's hardware is not something most would be willing to do because the data is typically very specialized and or expensive to reproduce. The adapters are going out of use in several cases due to Amazon's GPU cloud compute nodes and laptops with better workstation cards. The adapters may stick around a bit longer in the advanced education sector. Thanks for the great show and keep up with the great work. And thanks to Jay for the email on that. It's always funny because sometimes we look at something, we're like, it doesn't really do what we want it to do. But then we get reminded that there may be a specialized market where it does exactly what they need it to do and in a way they can't really replicate.
It's true because in some of those GPU compute instances, there is not the need, as much of a need for bandwidth between the GPU and the system all the time, right? You need that bandwidth to transfer maybe a certain amount of workload, but then it could be working on that workload for a significant amount of time with all of the memory it needs resident on the graphics card, and it's sending back smaller pieces at a time. So if that were the case, then, you know, any kind of limitations of the express card interface would be minimized as well. This is still something I'm hoping that we can test here and maybe get a better idea. I've had a couple of people email me asking more specific questions about it. We've never actually used one in any kind of benchmarking or testing or user experience scenario. So I think that would be interesting to see still.
It's funny, if you've never been up there, aws.amazon.com/ec2/instance types. It's really easy and kind of fun to make fun of cloud computing, especially if you work for a large organization that, you know, 20 years ago, everything was done at the server, and 10 years ago, everything moved from the server room to the desktops, and now it's moving from the desktops to the cloud, and in another 10 years, the pendulum will have swung in the other direction. But it's interesting when you look at these, like, sort of the general purpose, the M3, compute-optimized C3, and memory-optimized R3, where you know, they actually have cloud computing power that are optimized depending on whether the bottleneck is memory or CPU or GPU. You know, and it's such an interesting idea that you have some mad amount of data, you know, where the ability to rent time on workstations with, you know, NVIDIA GPUs with 1536 CUDA cores and 4 gigabyte of video memory. It's an interesting thought, right? So you can just, you know, throw your data up in Amazon's cloud services and get that back. Use cases, game streaming, video encoding, 3D application streaming, and other server-side graphics workloads. Yeah, it's you know, there's a whole lot of technology and a whole lot of computing power out there being used in a whole lot of interesting ways, which makes me wonder how many people are mining some form of Dogecoins or Litecoins or Bitcoins. Amazon's.
Check all your nest prices.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that would be pretty bad. Somebody sneaking into Amazon's servers and being like, I'll just take these ones over here that are dormant. Man. The electrical bill on that would be epic. And with that, is there anything, you know, you're sort of back to back this week. Is there anything you can give us, tease us about that's coming up on PCPro.com?
Other than my car work that's being done over the week, I'm trying to think of what else is even happening. We do have a review of, so we've had some requests to refocus away from the $3,000 video cards and back on the video cards that people can actually purchase. So we're working on a review of a couple of Radeon cards. One of them is an MSI R9-280, and one of them is an MSI GTX 780. And then we also got in an ASUS 780 that is like supposed to be almost completely silent throughout 95% of its workloads and capabilities. So I'm interested to see if they can live up to those claims. And then we also have another PCI Express SSD from OCZ that Alan is finishing up a story on as well. So that should all be up between now and the next time we talk.
Nice. I got to say, I'm still in love with the 750 Ti. and that
still a good one.
It's amazing. And I still love that story you guys did where you rounded up a bunch of like $300 machines from Best Buy and then lobbed it in there. Yeah, it's been interesting. I too was up to my eyeballs in automotive work this week. But we had some fun on Die Trying this week. Next week is probably much more interesting. Monday's show is probably much more interesting to people listening to Twitch because we did how to repair headphones and basically how to solder the little tiny terrible wires that fail in headphone connections. And it's all about lighting things on fire, which is always a big plus. but we've got a review of the Philips Hue bulbs, which are the Wi-Fi enabled bulbs coming up on Techzilla, the Moto G. And then Robert Heron was on this week answering a bunch of HDTV questions on Techzilla, and it's always good to have him back. He also did a review of Unlocator, which if you've ever had problems with blacked out MLB games, should be something that you take a good look at. That's a really cool application, which is also, oddly enough, cloud-based. And with that, I'm going to end the show before what's left of my voice finally fails. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for writing in and asking your questions. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch. I got the happy kitten. Alan Malventano beats the kitten against the webcam lens. That needs to be turned into an animated GIF. It really does.
What's coming up next on the stream? No, that is not correct. That is not coming up next on the stream.